AccessCast, an Accessibe initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibe and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibe, that's AccessibE. Visit www.accessibe.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Hi, and welcome to another episode of Unstoppable Mindset. Today we get to interview Howard Brown. I'm not going to tell you a lot because I want him to tell his story. He's got a wonderful story to tell, an inspiring story, and he's got lots of experiences that I think will be relevant for all of us and that we all get to listen to. So with that, Howard, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Thank you, Michael. I'm really pleased to be here, and thanks for having me on your show. And excited to talk to your audience and share a little bit.
Well, I will say that Howard and I met through Podapalooza, which I've told you about in the past, an event that brings podcasters, would-be podcasters, and people who want to be interviewed by podcasters together. And Howard will tell us which or several of those he is, because he really is involved in a lot of ways. But why don't you start maybe by telling us a little bit about your kind of earlier life and introduce people to you and who you are.
Sure, sure. So I'm from Boston. I can disguise the accent very well. But when I talk to my mother, we're back in Boston. We're parking our car. We're going for hot dogs and beans over to Fenway Park.
So got to get a soda.
We're getting a soda, not a pop. So we add the R's. They call my wife Lisa, not Lisa. Lisa. Yeah. But so I grew up in the suburbs of Boston, a town called Framingham, and I'm a twin, and very unusual, but I'm a girl boy twin. My twin sister, Cheryl, she goes by CJ, is 5 minutes older. And I hold that now against her now that we're older. She didn't want to be older, but now she's my older sister, my big sister by 5 whole minutes.
Well, she's your big sister, so she needs to take care of her baby brother.
Yes, exactly. And she did. And we're going to get to that because it's a really important point being a twin, which we'll catch to in a second.
But so where does she live now?
So she lives 40 minutes away from me here in Michigan.
Oh, my gosh. You both have moved out of the area.
So she moved to Albany, New York. I moved to Southern, then California, L.A. area on the beaches, and then Silicon Valley. And then the last 17 years, we've all lived close and we've raised our families together here in the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan.
What got you to all go to Michigan?
Well, for me, it was a choice. My wife is from Michigan, and I was in Silicon Valley, and we had a little girl, Emily, who's 4. There's a story there, too. But we decided we wanted her to grow up with family and cousins and aunts and uncles, and my in-laws live here. My wife grew up here, and it made it closer for my parents in Boston suburbs to get here as well. So a great place to raise a family. Very different from Silicon Valley and Palo Alto, California.
Yeah, but don't you miss Steve's ice cream in Boston?
I do. I miss Steve's ice cream. I miss the cannolis in the Back Bay. I miss some of the Chinese food. In the North End, but I do. But I have not lived there. I went to college there at Babson College, number one school for entrepreneurship. And then when I got my first job, I moved out to Ohio, but then I moved back, and there's a whole story of why I had to move back as well, but we'll get there.
So are your parents still living in Boston?
They are. And so my dad, I call myself son of a boot man. My dad, for 49 years, has sold cowboy boots In New England, in the Western, you know, the states, New York, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts. And that's, you know, anyone who stayed somewhere for 49 years got to be applauded. And he was a straight commission boot salesman, and he sold women's shoes prior to that. So he's a Renaissance man.
Wow. So does he sell cowboy boots with snow treads, as it were, for the winter?
No snow treads, but you know, like out west, when you're working on with cattle and working out west, and sometimes it's a fashion statement. Not too many places in New England like that. But he made a living, he enjoyed it, and he's just about to retire at the age of 79 this year.
I remember living in Boston, and when I wore shoes with just leather soles, I slid around a lot on the sidewalks and all that. So did get rubbers to go over my boots, and then later got real boots.
Right. So I have the big hiking boots, the Timberlands, but I too have a pair of, and you know, in Boston, we call them rubbers.
Rubbers, yeah.
And they basically are slip-ons that gave you grip. They slipped right over your leather shoes, and you wore them when in the snow and in the slush and in the mess. Yeah.
And they worked really well.
They did.
So you went off to college, and I gather kind of almost right from the beginning, you got involved in the whole idea of entrepreneurship.
Well, I did. I transferred to Babson from a liberal arts school called Connecticut College. I found out it wasn't for me. And Babson College changed the trajectory of my entire life. I knew that I wanted to do sales and then later technology, but Babson was the catalyst for that. They support entrepreneurship of all kinds, no matter how you define it. And I just drank it in, and I loved my time there. I love my learning there, and I continue to stay involved with Babson very closely as a past president of the Alumni Association, a former trustee, and very actively recruit students to go there and support student businesses. So it was a big impact on me, and I continue to give back to it.
That's pretty cool. So how did you proceed as far as a career in entrepreneurial involvement, as it were, and in sales and all that?
So I had an internship. I had one at Cellular One when cellular phones came out, and I was basically learning the business. This is really early. This is 1984 and five. And then I got another internship at NCR Corporation. If you remember National Cash Register, 120-year-old company, yes, based out of Dayton, Ohio, and now it's in Atlanta, and it's just not the same company. But no. I took an internship there. A lot of Babson folks work there, and I worked as a trainer, a sales installation rep. I trained waitresses, waiters, bartenders, hotel clerks, night audits, how to use cash register computer systems. So I was the teacher and a trainer, and I would talk to waitresses and waiters and bartenders and say, you can make more tips by providing better service. But the way that you do that is you type the order into a computer. It zaps it to the order station or the back of the house to cook, to prepare the foods or for the drinks. And you can spend more time servicing your table, which should translate into higher tips. Well, about a third of them said, nope, not for me. A third of them were need to be convinced. And a third of them were like, I'm in. So I had a lot of fun doing that. And then after the shift, either the manager or the owner would come over and they'd give you a savior at a Chinese food restaurant. They give you a poo-poo platter to go to take home to your dorm room. So I had a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
And a lot of good food.
Sure, sure. So that's what really started me off. And so, NCR hired me.
So did that concept of tips and all that and advising people ever get you to translate that to Durgan Park?
I actually did install the cash register computers at Durgan Park.
There you go.
In Faneuil Hall. So the checkerboard, draped, cloth on the table. And there's a lot of good restaurants in Boston. The Union Oyster House where the toothpick, yep, was invented. So, but I did countless restaurants, hotels, bars. I was basically at the helm of the sales force, and there was a couple of us that went to go train and teach people and take the night shift and make sure everything was going smoothly as they installed the new system.
Of course, the No Name restaurant, another one. But
for your listeners, the No Name was a place to get, really great discounted seafood, but you sat on a park bench. Remember that, Michael?
Right. Oh, yeah.
You sit on a park bench.
A park bench.
It wasn't fancy.
Well, neither was Durgan Park, but yeah, I haven't kept up. Is it still there?
I believe it's still there.
Oh, yeah. Good. I thought I heard somewhere that it might not be because of COVID, but we enjoyed.
It shut down for a while during COVID. But I hope it's back open. I'm going to have to go now. Yeah, you're going to make me go check to see if it's open. But you know, many of them are still there. And obviously, restaurants turn over, but that's a mainstay. That's got a lot of history to it.
Oh, it does. And we had a lot of fun with the waitresses and so on at Durgan Park. I know once we went there, and you know the whole story that Durgan is a place where you sit at family tables, unless you actually have four people, then they'll let you sit at one of the tables for four around the outside. Well, there were three of us and my guide dog when we went in one time. And the hostess said, we're going to put you at one of the tables for four, just to give more room for the puppy dog. And she sat us down there. Then the waitress came over, and as they are supposed to do at Durgan Park, she said, you're not supposed to sit here. There are only three of you. And I said, there's a dog under the table. No, there's not. You can't fool me with that. And the waitresses are supposed to be snotty, right? And she just kept going on and on about it. And I kept saying, there is a dog under the table. She went away. Then she came back a little bit later and she said, you've got to move. And I said, no, why don't you just look? There's a dog under the table. You're not going to make me fall for that. She finally looked. And there are these golden retriever puppy eyes staring back at her. She just melted. It was so much fun.
Well, it wouldn't be Boston if you didn't get a little attitude.
Well, right? Yeah, that's part of what it's all about.
But you're right, mixed seating. And they sit you and they say, meet each other and be merry.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a lot of fun. How long did it take you to get to Silicon Valley?
Well, so the story is that I worked for NCR and I got hired by NCR, but I wanted out of the hospitality business. Even though I was young, work until 2-3 in the morning once they shut the restaurant or bar down or the hotel down, and then you do the night audit and you do the records. It was a hard life. So I looked and I did my research and I said, who's making all the money here at NCR in the banking division? And it was really the early days of the outsourcing movement. We were doing punch cards and we're outsourcing bank accounts over 1,200 baud modems. And I said, wow, that's interesting. And so I went to NCR's training at Sugar Camp to learn how to be a salesperson, where they actually, in the early days, they filmed you. They taught you negotiation skills, competitive analysis, industry skills. It was fantastic. It's like getting an MBA today, but they did it all in 6 months with mixing field work in with training at this education facility in Dayton, Ohio. And I came out as a junior salesperson working for four very experienced guys. And they just, I knew one thing, if I made them more productive, they'd make me money. And I did. And they sent me to banks and savings and loans and credit unions all over New England. And I basically learned the business of banking and outsourcing to these banks. And they made me a lot of money. So that was how my career started.
You can't do better than that.
But to answer the question, because it's a little more complex than that, but it took me NCR in 1988. And then I moved out to Los Angeles in 1991 after a big health scare, which we'll talk about. And then I moved up in 2005. So there's the timeline to get me to Silicon Valley.
Wow. So you definitely moved around. I know that feeling well, having had a number of jobs and being required to live in various parts of the country and going back and forth from one coast to another from time to time. So, it's there. So you did all of that and you ended up obviously making some money and continuing to be in the entrepreneurial world. But how does that translate into kind of more of an entrepreneurial spirit today?
So great question, Michael. So what happened was, is that I built a foundation. So at that time, when you graduated school, and as far as for technology, the big computer shops like IBM, Unisys, NCR, Hewlett Packard, what they did is they took you raw out of college and they put you through their training program. And that training program was their version of their gospel, of their product and your competitors and all that. And that built a great foundation. Well, I moved to Los Angeles after this big health scare, which I'm sure we're going to go back and talk about. And I moved into the network products division. So I didn't stay in the banking division. I looked at the future and said, voice data and video, I think there's the future there. And I was right. And AT&T bought NCR. And unfortunately, this is probably 1992. They also bought Macaw Cellular. They had just bought Olivetti Computer. They were a big company of 500,000-600,000 employees. And I have to tell you, the merger wasn't great. You felt like a number. And I knew that was my time. That was my time where I said, I got my foundation built. It's now time to go to a startup.
So your time had come.
My time had come. So AT&T offered early retirement for anyone 50 and older. And then they didn't get enough takers. So they offered early retirement for anyone that wanted a change. And so the talk around the water cooler was, let's wait. They'll make a better offer. And I was like, I'm 26 and a half years old. What am I waiting for? So they made a tremendously generous offer. I took early retirement and I moved to my first true startup called Avid Technology that was in the production space. We basically were changing film and television production from analog to digital. And I never looked back. I basically have been with startups ever since. And but that foundation I felt was really important that I got from NCR. But I prefer smaller companies and building them up, from scratch and moving them forward.
Yeah, when you can do more to help shape the way they go, because the problem with a lot of larger companies is they get very set in their ways, and they tend not to listen as much as maybe they should to people who might come along with ideas that might be beneficial to them, as opposed to startups, as you say.
Well, it depends. I mean, you want to build a company that is still somewhat innovative. So what these large companies like Google and Facebook do and Apple is they go acquire. They acquire the startups before they get too big, or sometimes like Facebook did with Instagram, they acquired six people. Google acquired YouTube, and they acquire the technology, a best in breed technology, and then they shape it and they accelerate it up. So listen, companies like IBM are still innovative. Apple, is still innovative. But you need to maintain that, because it can get to be a bureaucracy and with hundreds of thousands of employees, and you can't please everybody. But I knew my calling was technology startups, and I needed to get that foundation built, and then away I went, and that's what I've done since.
You're right. It's all about with companies, if they want to continue to be successful, they have to be innovative and they have to be able to grow. I remember being in college when Hewlett-Packard came out with the HP 25, which was a very sophisticated calculator back in the early 1970s. And then Texas Instruments was working on a calculator. They came out with one that kind of did a lot of the stuff that HP did. But about that same time, because HP was doing what they were doing, they came out with the HP 35. And basically it added, among other things, a function key that basically doubled the number of incredible things that you could do on the HP 25.
Right. I had a TI calculator in high school.
Well, and of course, HP used reverse Polish notation, which was also kind of fun.
Right. And then what the kids don't understand today is that, we took typing. We took typing.
You had to learn how to type. Did you learn to type on a typewriter without letters on the keys?
No, I think we had letters. I think you just couldn't look down, or else you'd get smacked. You couldn't look down. The teacher, the big brown fox jumped over the, something fancy. I don't know, but I did learn, but I'm sort of a hybrid. I look down once in a while when I type.
I remember taking a typing course in summer school. I think it was between seventh and eighth grade. And of course the typewriters were typewriters for teaching. So they didn't have letters on the keys, which didn't matter to me a whole lot, but by the same token, that's the way they were. But I learned to type, and we learned to type, and we learned how to be pretty accurate with it. Sort of like learning to play the piano and eventually learning to do it without looking at the keys, so that you could play and either read music or learn to play by ear.
That's true. And again, in my dorm room, I had a Smith Corona, and I ended up having many bottles of Whiteout.
Yes. Whiteout. And then there was also the other paper that you could put on that almost did the same thing, but Whiteout really worked.
Yeah. You put that little strip of tape and then it would white it out for you. Then you could type over it.
Right.
We've come a long way, and some of that's good and some of it's bad.
Yeah, now we have spell checker.
Yeah, we do.
For what it's worth. which can be
we got more than that on these. I mean, listen, this is allowing us to do a Zoom call here and record, and there's goods and bads to all of that.
Yeah, I still love to tell people learning to edit now using a sound editor called Reaper. I can do a lot more clean editing than I was able to do when I worked at a campus radio station and had to edit by cutting tape and splicing with splicing tape.
Exactly. And that's what Avid changed. Yeah. So yeah. Michael, we changed Avid changed the game because we went from splicing tape or film and Betamax cassettes in the broadcast studios to a hard drive and a mouse.
Right.
We changed the game there because you were now editing on a hard drive. And so I was part of that in 1994. And again, timing has to work out. And we had to retrain the unions at the television networks. And it was just timing worked really well because my next startup, Liquid Audio, the timing didn't work out well because we were going to try to do the same thing in the audio world, which is download music. But when you do that, when it's a Sony cassette and Sony Walkman days, the world wasn't ready yet. We still went public. We still did a secondary offering, but we never really brought product to market because it took Steve Jobs 10 years later to actually sell a song for 99 cents and convince the record industry that that was, you could sell slices of pizza instead of the whole pizza, the whole record out, and still make money.
I remember Avid devices and hearing about them and being in television stations. And of course, for me, none of that was accessible. So it was fun to be able to pick on the fact that no matter what, as Fred Allen, although he didn't say it quite this way, once said, they call television the new medium because that's as good as it's ever going to get. But anyway, it has come a long way, but it was so sophisticated to go into some of the studios with some of the even early equipment like Avid and see all the things that they were doing with it. It just made life so much better.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was selling $100,000 worth of software on a Macintosh, which first of all, the chief engineers didn't even like. But at the post-production facilities, they drank that stuff up because you could make a television commercial, you could do retakes, you could add all the special effects, and it could save time, and then you could get more revenue from that. And so it was pretty easy sale because we tell them how fast they could pay off the hardware, the software, and then train everybody up. And they were making more and better commercials for the car dealerships and the local burger joint. And they were thrilled at these local television stations. I can tell you that.
I sold some of the first PC-based CAD systems and the same sort of thing. Architects were totally skeptical about it until they actually sat down and we got them in front of a machine and showed them how to use it and let them design something that they could do in 3 or 4 hours, as opposed to spending days with paper and paper and paper and more paper and a drafting table. And then they could go on to the next project and still charge as much.
It was funny. I take a chief engineer out to lunch and I try to gauge their interest. And a third were just enthusiastic because they wanted to make sure that they were the way that technology came into the station. They were the brainchild. They were the domain experts. So a third, again, just like training waitresses and waiters and bartenders, a third of them, they just wanted to consume it all. A third of them were skeptical and needed convincing. And a third of them was like, that's never going out on my air.
Never going anywhere, yeah.
They were the later adopters, of course.
And some of them were successful and some of them were not.
Absolutely. It's just the continuum.
Were you along the way? Oh, go ahead.
No. Of course, my first sales were the ones that were early adopters. And then I basically walk over to guys that are later adopters. I said, the ABC, the NBC, and the Fox station and the PBS station have it. You don't have it. And they're going to take all your post-production business away from you. And that got them highly motivated.
Yeah. And along the way, from a personal standpoint, somebody got really clever. And it started, of course, at WGBH in Boston, where they recognized the fact that people who happen to be blind would want to know what's going on TV when the dialogue wasn't saying much to offer clues. And so they started putting in audio description and editing all that. And somebody created the secondary audio programming and the other things that go into it. And now that's becoming a lot more commonplace, although it's still got a long way to go.
Well, I agree. But you're right. So having that audio or having it for visually impaired or hearing impaired or all that, we're making some progress. Still a ways to go. I agree with you there.
Still a ways to go. Well, you along the way, in terms of continuing to work with Avid and other companies and doing the entrepreneurial stuff, you've had a couple of curveballs from life.
I have. So going back to my promotion, I was driving out to Dayton, Ohio. I noticed a little spot on my cheekbone, didn't think anything of it. I was so excited to get promoted and start my new job. I just kept powering through. So a few weeks after I had moved out to Dayton, Ohio, my mom comes out and she's at the airport, and typical Boston mom, she's like, "What's that on your cheek? What's that on your cheek?" And I was like, "Mom, it's nothing." I kind of started making excuses. "Oh, I got hit playing basketball. I got hit at the gym or something." And she's like, "Well, we got to get that checked out." I said, "No, Mom, it's okay. It's no big deal. It's a little mark. Maybe it's a cyst or a pimple or something. I don't know." So she basically said she was worried, but she never told me. So she helped set up my condo or an apartment. And then she left. And then as long behold, I actually had to go speak in Boston at the American Bankers Association about disaster recovery and having a disaster recovery plan. Mm-hmm. And so this is August of 1989. And I came back and that spot was still there. And so my mom told my dad, remember, there was payphones. There was no cell phones, no computers, and no internet. So she told my dad, she didn't take a picture of it, but now he saw it. And he goes, "Let's go play tennis." I got there on a Friday. So on a Saturday morning, we'd go do something. And instead of going to play tennis, he took me to a local community hospital and they took a look at it. And they said, "Oh, it's a cyst. Take some antibiotic, erythromycin or something. You'll be fine." Well, I came back to see them on Monday after my speech. And I said, "I'm not feeling that great. Maybe it's the erythromycin." And so it happened to be 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He took me to the same emergency room. And he said, and I happened to have the same doctor on call. He actually said, "You know what? Let's take a biopsy of it." So he took a biopsy of it. And then he went back to the waiting room. He said, "I didn't get a big enough slice. Let me take another." So he took another. And then my dad drove me to the airport and I basically left. And my parents called me maybe 3 weeks later and they said, "You got to come back to Boston. We got to go see, they got the results, but they didn't tell us. They'll only tell you because it's my private data." Mm-hmm. So I flew back to Boston, met with my parents. And this time I had another doctor there with this emergency room doctor. And he basically checks me out, but he doesn't say too much. But he does say that we have an appointment for you at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute at 2 p.m. I think you should go. And I was like, "Whoa, what are you talking about? Why am I going to Dana-Farber Cancer Institute?" So it gets kind of scary there because I show up there. I'm in a suit and tie. My dad's in a suit and tie. My mom seems to be dressed up. And we go and they put me through tests. And I walk in there and I don't know if you remember this, Michael, but the Boston Red Sox charity is called the Jimmy Fund.
Right.
And the Jimmy Fund are for kids with blood cancers, lymphoma, leukemias. So I go there and they check me in and they tell me there's a whole host of tests they're going to do. And I'm looking in the waiting room and I see mostly older people and I'm 23 years old. So I go down the hallways and I see little kids. So I go hang out with the little kids while I'm waiting. I didn't know what was going on. So they call me in, I do my test. And this Dr. George Kanellis, who's, what I came to learn that the inventor of some chemotherapies for lymphoma, is very experienced. And this young Harvard fellow named Eric Rubin, I get pulled into this office with this big mahogany desk. And they say, "You have stage 4E T-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma."
Oh, gosh.
It's a very aggressive form of cancer. We're going to try to knock this out. I have to tell you, Michael, I don't really remember hardly anything else that was said. I glossed over. I looked up at this young guy, Eric Rubin, and I said, "What's he saying?" I look back out of the corner of my eye. My mom's bawling her eyes out. My dad looks like a statue. And I have to tell you, I was really just a deer in the headlights. I had no idea that how a healthy 23-year-old guy gets, stage 4 T-cell lymphoma with a very horrible prognosis. They said, "We don't know if we can help you," at the world, one of the world's foremost cancer research hospitals in the world. So it was, that was a tough pill to swallow. And I did some more testing and then they told me to come back in about a week to start chemotherapy. And so again, I didn't have the internet to search anything. I had encyclopedias. I had some friends, and I was like, I'm a young guy. And I was talking to older people that had potentially, had leukemia or a different cancer, but I didn't know much. And so I I basically showed up for chemotherapy, scared out of my mind, in denial. And Dr. Rubin comes out and he says, "We're not doing chemo today." I said, I didn't sleep a wink. What are you talking about? He says, we'll try again tomorrow. Your liver function test is too high." And my liver function test is too high. So I'm starting to learn, but I still don't know what's going on. He says, let's go on a field trip." "A field trip?" He said, "Yeah, you're going down the street to Newton Wellesley Hospital. We're going to the cryogenic center." I said, "Cryo what? What are you talking about?" He goes, "It's a sperm bank and you're going to go, you know, leave a sample, a specimen." And I was like, "You just told me that. You don't know if you can help me. Why? I'm not even thinking about kids right now." He said, "Go do it." He says, "What else are you going to do today? And then you come back tomorrow and we'll try chemo." So thank God he said that, because I deposited before I actually started any chemotherapy, which, has basically, rendered me, impotent now because of all the chemotherapy and radiation I had. So that was a blessing that I didn't know about until later, which we'll get to. But I'll roll the story forward a little more quickly, is that I was getting all bad news. I was relapsing. I went through about 3 or 4 different cycles of different chemotherapy recipes. Nothing was working. I was getting sicker, and they typed my sister, the twin, CJ, for bone marrow transplant. And she was a 25% chance of being a match. She happened to be 100% match. And I had to then gear up for, back in 1990, was a bone marrow transplant, where they would remove her bone marrow from her hip bones. They would scrub it and cleanse it, and they would put it in me. And they would hope that my body wouldn't immediately reject it and die and shut down, or over time, which is called graft versus host disease, that it wouldn't kill me, or potentially that it would work and it would actually reset my immune system and it would take over the malignant cells and set me back straight, which it ended up doing. And so having a twin was another blessing, miracle, that happened to me. And I did some immunotherapy called interleukin-2 that was like the grandfather of immunotherapy that strengthened my system. And then I moved to Florida to get out of the cold weather. And then I moved out to California to rebuild my life. I call that Humpty Dumpty, building Humpty Dumpty version 1. And that's how I got to California, Southern California.
So once again, your big sister saved the day.
As usual.
That's a big sister.
We call ourselves the Wonder Twins. She's more wonderful. She's terrific. And thank God she gave part of herself and saved my life. And I am eternally grateful to her for that.
But she never had any of the same issues or diseases, I gather.
She's been very healthy, except for like a partial knee replacement. She's been very healthy her whole life.
Well, did she have to have a knee replacement because she kept kicking you around, or what?
No, she's little. She's 5 feet. I'm 5'10". So she never kicked me. We are best friends. My wife's best friend.
I know.
She is just a saint. She's such a giving person. And, we take that from our parents, but she gave of herself of what she could do. She said she'd do it again in a heartbeat. I don't think I'm allowed to give anybody my bone marrow, but if I could, I would give it to her, do anything for her. She's amazing. So she gave me the gift of life. Yes.
So you went to Florida, then you moved to California. And what did you do when you got out here?
So I ended up moving up to Northern California. So I met this girl from Michigan in Southern California, Lisa, my wife of now 28 years in July. We got married under the Jewish wedding canopies called the Chuppah. Yep. And we're looking at the Pacific Ocean. We made people come out. That we had that Northridge earthquake in 94, but this is in July. So things were more settled. So we had all friends and family come out, and it was beautiful. We did it on a pool deck overlooking the Pacific. It was gorgeous. It was a beautiful Hollywood type wedding. And it was amazing. So we got married in July of 94, and then moved up to Silicon Valley in 97. And then I was working at these startups. My life was really out of balance because I'm working 20 hours a day, and I'm traveling like crazy. And my wife says, "You know what? You got to be home for dinner if we're going to think about having a family. And we're a little bit older now, 35 and 40. And so we've got to think about these things." And so I called back to Newton Wellesley Hospital, and I got the specimen of sperm shipped out to San Jose. And we went through an in vitro fertilization process. And she grew eight eggs, and they defrosted the swimmers, and they took the best ones and put them back in the 4 best eggs. And our miracle baby, our frozen kitsicle, Emily, was born in August of 2001. Another blessing, another miracle that I was able to have a child and a healthy baby girl.
So what's Emily doing today?
Well, thank you for asking that. So she is now in Missoula, Montana at a television station called KPAX 8 Mountain News. And she is an intern for the summer. And she's living her great life out there hiking Glacier National Park. And she ran down to the Grand Tetons. And she's learning about the broadcast business and reporting. She's a writer by trade and in journalism. And she likes philosophy. So she'll be coming back home to finish her senior year this at the end of the summer at the University of Michigan. And so she's about to graduate in December, and she's doing just great.
So she writes and doesn't do video editing using Abbott or any of the evolutions from it.
No, she does. She actually, you're at a small market station, everything. You write the script. She does the recordings. She has a tripod. Sometimes she films with the other reporters, but when they send her out as an intern, and she just covered the pro life and pro choice rallies. She records herself. She edits on Pro Tools, which is super powerful now and a lot less expensive. And then she submits it for review to the news director and to her superiors. And she's already got I think 3 video stories and about 6 different bylines on written stories. So she's learning by doing. It's experiential. It's amazing.
So she must have had some experience in dealing with all the fires and stuff out at Yellowstone and all that.
So the flooding at Yellowstone, I drove her out there in May, and I didn't see any fires, but the flooding, we got there before that. She took me on a hike on the North Gate of Yellowstone, and she's you know, environmentally wilderness trained, first aid trained, and I'm the dad, and I'm in decent shape, but she took me out on an hour out and an hour back in, and saw moose, saw a deer, didn't see any mountain lion, didn't see any grizzlies, thank God, but we did see moose carcass where a grizzly had got a hold of one of those, and everybody else took care of it. So I got to go out to nature with her, and we took a road trip out there this summer. It was a blast. Those are the memories when you've been through a cancer diagnosis that you hold on to very dearly and very tight. It was a blast. So that's what she's doing this summer. She'll be back. She'll be back in August, end of August.
That's really exciting to hear that she's working at it and being successful, and hopefully she'll continue to do that and do good reporting. And I know that this last week with all the Supreme Court cases, it's, I guess, in one sense, a field day for reporters, but it's also a real challenge because there's so many polarized views on all of that.
Well, everybody's a broadcaster now, whether it's Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and all the other ones out there, TikTok. So everybody's sort of a reporter now. And, what do you believe? And unfortunately, you can't believe in something in 140 characters or something in 2 sentences. There's no depth there. So sometimes you miss the point and all this stuff. And then everything's on 24 hours on CNN, on Fox, on MSNBC. So it never stops. So I call that a very noisy world. And it's hard to process, all this. It's coming at you so fast in the blink of an eye. So we're in a different time than when we grew up, Michael. It was a slower pace. Today in this digital world, it's a lot. And especially coming through COVID now, where we're just consuming and consuming and binging and all this stuff. I don't think it's that healthy.
It's not only a noisy world, but it's also a world that's very disconnected. You can say all you want about how people can send tweets back and forth, text messages back and forth, and so on, but you're not connecting. You're not really getting deep into anything. You're not really establishing relationships in the way that, as you point out, we used to. And we don't connect anymore. Even emails don't give you that much connectionalism as opposed to having meaningful dialogue and meaningful conversations. And we just don't converse anymore. And now, with all that's going on and the very divided opinions, there's no room for discussion because everybody has their own opinion and that's it. There's no room to dialogue on any of it at all, which is really too bad.
Yeah, I agree. It's been divisive. And, it's hard because, an email doesn't have the body language, the intent, the emotion, like we're talking right now. And, we're expressing, I'm telling stories of my story personally, but you can tell when I get excited, I smile, I can get animated. sometimes with an email, you don't know the intent, and it can be misread. And a lot of that communication is that way. So, you know, I totally get where you're coming from.
And that's why I like doing the podcast that we're doing. We get to really have a conversation. It isn't just asking some questions and getting an answer and then going on to the next thing. That's frankly no fun. And I think it's important to be able to have the opportunity to really delve into to things and have really good conversations about them. I learn a lot. And I keep saying, as I do these podcasts, and for the past 20 plus years, I've traveled around the world speaking, of course, about September 11th and talking about teamwork and trust and so on. And as I always say, if I don't learn more than I'm able to teach or impart, then I'm not doing my job very well.
So that's exactly, and that's where I'm going. And after the second health concern, I'm now going to teach. I'm going to inspire. I'm going to educate, and that's what I do. I want to do with the rest of my time is to be able to, listen. I'm not putting my head in the sand about school shootings, about an insurrection, about floods, about all that. You got to live in the real world. But I choose, as I say, I like to live on Positive Street as much as possible, but Positive Street with action. That's what makes the world a better place at the end of the day. So you sharing that story means that one will never forget, and you can educate the generations to come that need to understand, that point in time and how it affected you and how you've dealt with it and how you've been able to get back out of bed every day. And I want to do the same.
Well, there's nothing wrong with being positive. I think that there is a need to be aware, but yes. we can continue to be positive and try to promote positivity, try to promote connectionalism in conversations and so on, and promote the fact that it's okay to have different opinions, but the key is to respect the other opinion and recognize that it isn't just what you say, and that's the only thing that ever matters. That's the problem that we face so much today.
Right. Respect. I think Aretha Franklin sang that great song.
She did. She did.
So I agree. Well, and she's from Motown here.
There you go. See, when you moved out to California and you ended up in Silicon Valley and so on, who were you working for then?
So I moved up and I worked for this company called Liquid Audio that doesn't exist anymore. And it was just iTunes 10 years too early. There was Real Audio. There was Mark Cuban's company was called AudioNet and then Broadcast.com. He sold it to Yahoo for a lot of money. And so the company went public and made a lot of money, but it didn't, the world wasn't ready for it yet to be able to live in this cassette world. It was not ready. Napster hadn't been invented. MP3 and 4 hadn't been invented. So it just, the adoption rate of being too early, but it still went public. A lot of the investors made a ton of money, but they call that failing forward. So yes. I stayed there for a year. I made some money and I went to another startup, and that startup was in the web hosting space. It was called Navisite. It's now owned by Time Warner. But at that time, building data centers and hosting racks of computers was very good business. Mm-hmm. And so I got to participate in an IPO. I built up revenue, and the outsourcing craze, now called cloud computing, that's dominated by the folks at like Amazon and the folks at IBM. And a few others, but mostly, dominated there, where you're basically having lots of blinking lights in a data center and just making sure that those computers stay up to serve up the pages of the web, the videos, even television programming, and now any form of communication. So I was early on in that, and again, got to go through an IPO and get compensated probably unduly. But also my life was out of balance. And so, before we called out for the sperm and had a baby, I transitioned out when Silicon Valley, just the pendulum swung the other way. I ended up starting to work at my own nonprofit. I founded it with a couple of Silicon Valley guys called Planet Jewish, and it was still very technologically driven. It was the world's first community calendar. This is before Google Calendar. This is in 2000. And we built it as a nonprofit to serve the Jewish community, to get more people to come to Jewish events. And I architected the code, and we ran that nonprofit for 17 years and before calendaring really became free, and very proud of that. And after that, I started a very similar startup with different code called Circle Builder, and it was serving faith and religions. It was more like private Facebook or private online communities. And we had the Vatican as a client and about 25,000 ministries, churches, and nonprofits using the system. And this is all sort of when Facebook was coming out to, from being just an EDU or just for college students. And so I built that up as quite a big business. But unfortunately, I was in Michigan when I started Circle Builder. I ended up having to close both of those businesses down. One, that the revenue was tailing off of the nonprofit, and also Circle Builder wasn't monetizing as quickly or as we needed as well. But I ended up going in for my 50-year-old colonoscopy, Michael. And I woke up thinking everything was going to be fine. My wife Lisa's holding my hand, and the gastroenterologist said, "No, I found something. And when I find something, it's bad news." Well, it was bad news. Stage 3 colon cancer. Within about 10 days or 2 weeks, I had 13 and a half inches of my colon removed, plus margins, plus lymph nodes. One of the lymph nodes was positive. They install a chemo port. And then I waited because my daughter had soccer tournaments to travel to. But the first week of August in 2016, I started 12 rounds of Rock'em Sock'em chemotherapy called FOLFOX and 5-FU. And it was tough stuff. So I was back on the juice again, doing chemotherapy. And but this time I wasn't a deer in the headlights. I was a dad. I was a husband. I had been through the trenches. So this time I was much more of a Marine on a mission. And I had these digital tools to reach out for research and for advocacy and for support. Very different at that time. And so I unfortunately failed my chemotherapy. I failed my next surgery, another colon resection. I failed a clinical trial, and things got worse. I became metastatic, stage 4. That means that the colon cancer had spread to my liver, my stomach linings, called the omentum and peritoneum, and my bladder. And I had that same conversation with a doctor in downtown Detroit at a cancer institute. And he said, we don't know if we can help you. And if you Dr. Google, it said I had 4% of chances of living about 12 to 18 months. And things were dark. I was back at it again, looking at the Grim Reaper. But what I ended up doing is research. And I did respond to the second line chemotherapy with a little regression or shrinkage. And for that, you get more chemotherapy. And then I started to dig in deep research on peritoneal carcinoma, which is cancer of the stomach lining. And it's very tricky. And there's a group called colontown.org that I joined, and very informative. I there then met, at that time, was probably over 100 other people that had had the peritoneal carcinoma and are living, and they went through a radical surgery called cytoreduction HIPAC, where they basically debulk you like a deboning a fish, and they take out all this cancer they can see, the dead and live cells, and then they pour hot chemo in you. And that hot chemo is supposed to penetrate the skin and the organs. And it's supposed to, in theory, kill micro cell organism and cancer, although it's still not proven just yet. But that surgery was about a 12 and a half hour surgery in March of 2018. And they call that the mother of all surgeries. And I came out looking like a ghost. I had lost about probably 60 pounds, and I had a long recovery. That one with putting Humpty Dumpty back together has been now 6 years, but I got a lot of support. And I am now what's called no evidence of disease at this time. I'm still under surveillance. I was quarterly. I just in June had my scans and my exams, and I'm now going to biannual surveillance, which means CAT scans and blood tests. That's the step in the right direction. And so again, I mean, if I think about it, my twin sister saved my life. I had a frozen sperm become a daughter. And again, I'm alive from a stage 4 diagnosis. I am grateful. I am lucky and I am blessed. So that's a long story that the book will basically tell you, but that's where I am today.
And we'll definitely get to the book, but another question. Yes. So you had two startups that ran collectively for quite a period of time. What got you involved or motivated to do things in the faith arena?
So I have to give credit to my wife, Lisa. So we met at the Jewish Federation of Los Angeles at this young leadership group. And then they had like a college fair of organizations that are Jewish support organizations. And one of them happened to be Jewish Big Brothers, now Jewish Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Los Angeles. She goes, "You'd be a great Big Brother." I was like, "Well, it takes up a lot of time. I don't know." She's like, "You should check it out." So I did. And I filled out the application. I went through the background checks, and I actually got to be a Jewish Big Brother to this young man, Ian, at age 10. And so I have to tell you, one of the best experiences in my life was to become a mentor. And I today roll the clock forward 29 years. Ian is now close to 40 years old or 39 years old. He's married with a son who's one, Noble, and to wife, Sarah. And we are family. We stayed together past age 18 and we've continued on. And I know not a lot of people do that, but it was probably one of the best experiences I've ever done. I've gotten so much out of it. Everyone's like, oh, you did so much for Ian. Well, he did so much for me. And my daughter, Emily, calls him Uncle Ian. My wife and I are, we are his family. His dad was in prison and then passed away and his mom passed away. We're his family now. And so one of the best experiences. So that's how I kind of got into the Jewish community. And also being in sales, I ended up being a good fundraiser. And so these nonprofits that live, their lifeblood is fundraising dollars. I didn't mind calling people, asking them for donations or sitting down over coffee, asking them for donations. So I learned how to do that out in Southern California, then Northern California. And I've continued to do that. So that gave me a real good taste of faith. I'm not hugely religious, but I do believe in the community values of the Jewish community. And you get to meet people beyond boards and you get to raise money for really good causes. And so that sort of gave me another foundation to build off of. And I've enjoyed doing that as a community servant for a long time.
I'll bite. Where does Ian live today?
Okay. Well, Ian was in LA when we got matched. I had to move to San Francisco, but I petitioned the board to keep our match alive because it was scholarship dollars at stake.
Right.
And Ian went to UC Santa Cruz, Florida State for his master's and got his law degree at Hastings, and the Jewish community supported him with scholarships. And Ian was in very recently was in San Francisco, Oakland area. And now he's lives in South Portland, Oregon.
Ah, so you haven't got him back to Michigan yet, although he's getting into colder weather. So there's a chance.
Well, let me tell you, he did live with us in Michigan. So using my connections through the Jewish community, I asked if he could interview with a judge from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, a friend of mine who sat on me on a board of directors for the American Jewish Committee, Detroit. And I said, she said, well, Howard, I really have to take Michigan kids. I said, you know what? No problem. You decide if he's worthy or not. Go through your process. But would you take the phone call? So she took the phone call and I never heard anything. And then Ian called me and he said, I got it. I as a second year law, going to be a second year law student, am going to be clerking for summer interning and clerking for this Judge Helene White. And again, it karma, the payback, it was beautiful. So he lived with us for about 4.5 months. And when he came back, and it was beautiful because Emily was only about 4 or 5 years old and he lived with us for that time. And it was beautiful.
But that's really great that, that you have that relationship, that you did the Big Brother program. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming you've been Big Brother to other people as well.
No. I have not actually. Because what it did is it trained me to be a dad. So when I had Emily, it was more difficult actually to do that. And so no, Ian's been my one and only match. I mentor a lot of absent students and I mentor and get mentored by some cancer patients and some big entrepreneurs. Mentorship is a core value of mine. I like to be mentored and I also like to mentor others. And I think that's what makes the world go round. So when Bill Gates's wife, Melinda, just donated $123 million to the overall arching Big Brothers, Big Sisters of America, and that money will filter to all the others. I think that's such a core value. If a young person can have someone that takes interest in them, they can really shape their future and also get a lot out of it. So mentorship is one of my key values. And I hope it's many of your viewers and yours as well, Michael.
Absolutely is. I think that we can't do anything if we can't pass on what we've learned and try to help other people grow. I've been a firm believer my entire life of you don't give somebody a fish, you teach them how to fish. And however, and wherever that is, it's still the same thing. And we need to teach and impart. And I think that in our own way, every one of us is a teacher. And the more we take it seriously, the better it is.
Well, I'm now a student. I'm learning podcasting. I learned how to be a book author, and I'm learning how to reinvent myself. Virgin Humpty Dumpty version 2.0 coming out.
So you have been a national cancer survivor advocate and so on. Tell me a little bit about that, if you would.
So I respect people that want to keep their diagnosis private and their survivorship private. That's not me. I want to be able to help people, because if I would have been screened at age 40 or 42, I probably wouldn't have had colon cancer, and I was not. But this is a preventable disease. And really, minorities and indigenous people, they need to get screened more, because that's the highest case of diagnosis for colorectal cancer. But what I think that's what is needs. Now, it's the second leading killer of cancer right now. And it's an important to get this advocacy out and use your voice. And so I want to use my voice to be able to sound the alarm on getting screening, and also to help people survive. There's, I think, 16 million growing to 23 or 4 million by 2030 cancer survivors out there. Cancer diagnosis, it sucks, S-U-X, all the way around, but it affects more than the patient. It affects your caregiver. It affects your family. It affects relationships. It affects emotions, physical, and also financial. There's many aspects of survivorship here, and more people are learning to live with it and going. But also, quite frankly, I live in the stage four cancer world. You also live with an imminency of death or desperation to live a little bit longer. You hear people, I wish I had one more day. Well, I wished I had the time to be able to see my daughter graduate high school, and I did, and I cherished it. I'm going to see her graduate college this December, and then walk at the big house here in Michigan in Ann Arbor in May. And then, God willing, I will walk her down the aisle at the appropriate time. And it's good to have those big goals that are important that drive you forward. And so those are a few of the things that drive me forward.
I know that I can't remember when I had my first colonoscopy. It's been a while. It was just part of what I did. My mother didn't die of colon cancer, but she was diagnosed with colon cancer. She went to the doctor's office when she felt something was wrong, and they did diagnose it as colon cancer. She came home. My brother was with her. She fell and broke her hip and went into the hospital and passed away a few days later. They did do an operation to deal with repairing her hip. But I think because of all of that, just the amount that her body went through, she just wasn't able to deal with it. She was 69, 70. And so it was, it was just one of those things that did happen. She was 71, not 70. But, you know, for a while I got a colonoscopy every 5 years. And then they said, oh, you don't need to do it every 5 years, do it every 10 years. A couple of times they found little polyps, but they were just little things. There was nothing serious about them. They obviously took them out and biopsied them and all that, and no problems. And I don't remember any of it. I slept through it, so it was okay.
Right. So the prep is the worst part.
Isn't it though?
The prep's no fun, but the 20 minutes, they have you under light anesthesia. They snip the polyps and away you go, and you keep living your life. So that's what I hope for everyone, because I will tell you, Michael, going through the amount of chemotherapy, the amount of surgeries, and the amount of side effects that I have is I don't wish that on anyone. No. I don't wish that on anyone. It's not a good existence. It's hard. And quite frankly, I want to prevent about it. And I'm just not talking about colon cancer. Get your mammogram for breast cancer. Get your check for prostate cancer. Self-care is vital, because you can't have fun, do your job, work, grow a family, if you're not healthy. And the emotional stuff, they call it chemo brain or brain fog, or military personnel refer to it as PTSD. It's real. And you've got to be able to understand that, coming from a cancer diagnosis is a transition. And I'll never forget that my two experiences. And I've got to build and move forward, though, because otherwise it gets dark. It gets lonely, it gets depressing, and then other things start to break down. The parts don't work well. So I've chosen to find my happy place on the basketball court, be very active in sounding the alarm as an advocate. And I never planned on being a book author, and now I'm going to be a published author this summer. So there's good things that have come in my life. I've had a very interesting life, and we're here talking about it now. So I appreciate it.
Well, tell me about you and basketball. It seems to be your happy place.
So everyone needs to find a happy place. I'll tell you why. The basketball court, I've been playing since I was 6 years old, and I was pretty good. I'm not going to go professional, but I happen to like the team sport. And I'm a point guard, so I'm basically telling people what to do and trash talking and all that. But I love it as a form of exercise. It's a team game. Teams win. Not usually one person wins the basketball game, although Michael Jordan sort of proved me wrong there, but he still needed this four other players.
He still had to have the other guys.
You got to have the other guys. It's not like tennis or singles or golf, right? But so it ends up that I just love it. And so when I get to the basketball court, I use that as my metric of that I was really healthy and back. So I played when I had chemotherapy and when it was safe to do after surgeries, but I love it because on the basketball court, I'm in a zone where I have no cares in the world. I forget everything. There's no worries. I'm there playing hoops and it's with my fellas and I just enjoy the game. So I still play two or three times a week. I'm now an older guy, but I change my game. I shoot the three pointer. I can't cover the fastest guy in the court, but I just enjoy the camaraderie of it, the competition of it. And there's actually, you know, there's strategy to the game as well, but I enjoy it. And that's what keeps me going. And so I like hiking and I like biking and I like swimming. I like other stuff too, but the basketball place, I found my happy place. So whether it's yoga, nature, art, music, finding your happy place allows you to move from darkness to light. And that's one of the keys to resilience and to be able to getting back up and getting out of bed every day.
It is very much a team sport. I remember watching and listening to the Lakers the year they had a 69-13 win-loss record. And in the middle of it, Jerry West got injured. And I don't remember what the injury was. And everybody said, oh, it's all over. And they're not going to be able to continue. They continued to win. I think they lost one more game during that time percentage-wise than they otherwise probably would have. And they did before he left and after he came back. But it is a team game. And it's all about everyone learning to communicate and working together. And that's what teamwork, of course, is all about.
Absolutely. So my daughter was a goalie in soccer, much like a point guard. And that communication, that camaraderie, there's a lot. I think sports in general, it teaches a lot of life lessons. And our coaches, my friend Marty Davis wrote a book, 30 Days with America's Coaches. That's a noble profession because in your formative years as a young kid, all the way up through high school and even in college coaching, there's so much teaching that goes on. And I think our coaches, you know, need to be raised up, you know, with doctors and nurses and lawyers and others as well. So I love that. And I think that team sports allowed me to be a team player in the business world and a team player. Although my wife may contradict me a little bit in the family raising business because the wife does a little bit more, you know, but we're teamwork. We're a team effort to raise Emily and we raised a good girl.
There is no doubt that coaches play a lot in making a team effective. And of course, that's what coaches are supposed to do is to bring people together. And it's fascinating. We're Karen, especially because she's a graduate of USC, but I have always liked USC. I'm prejudiced because of the announcers, but we watch USC and it's interesting when they have good coaches, how the team plays better. And when the coaches aren't so great, you have issues. And I think that's true with whoever it is, because it's all about truly teaching leadership. And the coaches have to be the models and have to be the impetus for teaching and promoting good leadership, but it's also then motivating the players to do it.
Yeah, well, not teams lose, right? And with the coaches. Right. And so out here, Big Ten football and basketball is huge and hockey in Michigan. And so University of Michigan and Michigan State and Ohio State, they have these big rivalries. It's huge out here. It's big. And my wife and daughter are Michigan and my other part of my family is Michigan State. So there's green versus blue. I'm a Babson College Beaver. We're no football team. We're undefeated. We never never lost or won a game.
Hey, UC Irvine has been to March Madness twice.
They have. Anteaters? Are they the Anteaters?
Anteaters, yeah.
Wow. There
Zot. So you talk about International Peacemaker. What is that?
Okay. So I got involved when I moved to Michigan with an organization called the American Jewish Committee. And they have offices all over the world. I think 26 offices in the U.S. And their responsibility is to reach out in an interfaith manner to other communities, whether that's the African-American community, the Christian community, the Greek community, the Muslim community. And I was asked to be on their board, not knowing a lot about the organization. And being a student, and always wanting to learn, I got to learn the mission of this organization from a diplomatic side of things and with foreign ministries and ambassadors and consul generals, and also from the interfaith aspects of it. And here in Michigan, we have such a diverse community of Arab Muslims, Asian Muslims, African-American, we call them Iraqi Christians, called Chaldeans. And it's a big melting pot here. And then the car business brings in Japanese, Korean, and lots of other folks, Italy, because they own Chrysler. So we have a melting pot here in Michigan. You need to be able to understand, you can either live under a rock or in a walled garden, or you can actually go out and integrate with these communities that are here. I've chosen to go, and as Abraham says, and as he said, not religious, welcome the stranger. And so we now do interfaith relations, and the work is fascinating. We can't solve some of the problems around the world or in the Middle East, but what we can do is live as good neighbors here and respectful, as we talked about that word respect before. And it's fascinating work. It really gives me a sense of being well-rounded and understanding and learning these other cultures. So when I get invited to a Hindu event or a Greek event or a Muslim event, we're learning their cultures, their ways. And you know what? We're a lot more the same than we are different.
Yeah,
we really are at the end of the day.
That's as true with religion. If you go back to the basic tenets of most religions, they're the same. They teach the same thing.
They do. And so that's been a very dear part of my life. And I appreciate that part, because I learn that our values are very similar, but our customs could be different. And that's okay. And
that's
so
okay.
There's always, it's okay. And so, there are, you get these stereotypes out there that someone ran into a church and they shot up somebody, and it was a Muslim, or it was a ethnic person or a Chinese person, and all this. And I don't have a tolerance for hate. Hate mm-hmm. is hate. And I always say that we're not born with it. It's a learned skill.
It's a learned skill.
You adapt
skill.
And you learn that skill. When you come out of your mother's womb, you don't say I hate. You're mostly there for love. And so I do take that very seriously in communicating with that. But like anything else, I'm a student. I'm a lifelong learner. I'm learning, meeting new, interesting people. And that's the way I choose to operate. And I hope others will too.
We have heard you talk a whole lot today about your book, and I've been delaying because I wanted to save it till the end. Tell me all about your book.
Okay. So
we had to get there, right?
We're going to get there, Michael, and I appreciate it. I was being patient with you. I'm so excited.
I'm sure you have.
I did. It was not a bucket list. It was not something I wanted to do. I sat down with a dear friend named David Crum, who's the editor and publisher of Front End Communications and a weekly magazine called readthespirit.com. And it has some faith to it, but it has resilience to it. It's a beautiful, beautiful magazine. And he sat down at a bagel shop and we talked, and this is when things were really bleak for me. He says, do you want to leave a legacy? You want to write a book? And I said, no. And he came back after I came back from the bathroom with 10 chapter headings. And a month later, I called him back and I said, David, if I were to write a book, since I don't have a manuscript, we'd have to create one. I'm not a good writer. Grammar and punctuation sometimes are optional for me, but I could dictate my story to you. And if you allow me to, invite very influential people in my life to these Zoom sessions, we can get transcripts. And those transcripts could then become chapters. And have you ever done this before? He said, no. He said, well, let me get back to you. A couple weeks later, he got back to me and he said, Howard, I would like to do this with you. And so for the last 2 years, for every Wednesday for at least 2 hours, and tomorrow is no different, we have met over 200 times on Zoom. We record the sessions, and I've got to invite all people from walks of my life. I got to walk back my life during COVID, including David Crum, with friends from the neighborhood, with doctors from 30 years ago, with camp counselors, with my first bosses at NCR, the ones that are still alive. And it was fascinating, family members. And we created 18 chapters. 18 in Judaism is chai, it means life.
Yeah.
So 18 chapters was a good number for me. And we're getting down to the final proof. And the book is all about how my family came to be and how I came to be, but also these chapters on mentorship with Ian, the chapters on the cancers are there. There's a chapter on basketball and my thoughts on basketball. And there's a chapter on interfaith, and there's a chapter on sharing hope, because at the end of each chapter, I give homework to get interactive, and I offer suggestions to the reader to get interactive with me on a podcast or on my website, and to keep the conversation continuing. And Michael, I actually have merchandise. So I have Shining Brightly glasses. I have candles and t-shirts and mirrors, and it all related to the story, hats and water bottles. So I have merch. And so we're all shining brightly. And I'm just thrilled to get it, because publishing a book is hard work. There was 901 steps, my editor and publisher told me. And we're getting down to the starting line where it'll be available in mid-July on Amazon for pre-order. We'll do a lot of publicity. And then September 13th, worldwide availability of Shining Brightly in hard copy, soft paperback, and then ebook for Kindle and for Nook and all that. So,
well, I hope that you'll be able to do an audio version of it as well.
So I will. That is probably the fall. I've talked to a few folks as well and met some folks about it. And so the question is, do I want an English accent, or do I want to do it myself? So I'm probably going to do it myself.
Well, whether you do it or someone else, it should be someone who will essentially sound like you in terms of enthusiasm and everything else. But there's nothing wrong with you doing it.
I'll probably do it. I'll probably end up doing it. So, because people are downloading books and listening to books and like the podcast now. So I'll do that. But I'm going to get out the door this fall. The biggest thing that I'm doing right now, Michael, is speaking engagements. And my first takers happen to be hospitals, for fundraisers, med schools to speak to doctors and nurses in training, universities and pharmaceutical companies. Because most of them want to hear about a guy that's lived from two different cancer diagnoses 30 years apart.
Yeah.
It makes an interesting story, I hope. And then, but secondarily, I have a talk on fundraising. I have a talk on mentorship. I have a talk on building companies. And also I participate with the Sports Philanthropy Network, and we talk about sports and doing good in sports. So lots of different things. So I'm excited. This is just opening a whole new thing as we, for me, and I'm excited about it.
And that's as good as it can possibly be. It's really exciting. So the book is called Shining Brightly.
Yes.
And we're all going to be looking for that when it comes out. If people want to reach out to you and get to know you better or ask you questions or, explore you coming and speaking and so on, how do they do that?
Yeah, the easiest way is just add a .com to Shining Brightly. So shiningbrightly.com. If you go to the website, the first thing it does is an offer for a free pair of Shining Brightly sunglasses. If we all got to shine in this world. And so, but please contact me there. And there's a form there to fill out about speaking, consulting, fundraising, talk about the book. And I'm always willing to engage. Also looking for podcast guests and be a guest on others as well. So I'm very interactive, very responsive. And so shiningbrightly.com, please contact me there.
Perfect. So reach out to Howard, please, folks. Let him know that you heard our podcast and that you liked it. And I'd appreciate it if you'd let me know as well. We'd appreciate a 5-star rating wherever you're listening to this podcast. And if you'd like to reach out to me, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is michaelhi@accessibe.com, michaelhi@accessibe.com. Or you can go to michaelhingson.com/podcast, or just go to michaelhingson.com, where there's also a link to the podcast page, but you can also explore my coming to speak and talk to your organization or to your company about trust and teamwork and so on. And the advantage that I have when I come to speak is I always bring a dog with me who loves to get attention. So we have a lot of fun with that. But Howard, again, thank you very much for being here today. I'm really excited to get this podcast up and for people to get to know you better.
I appreciate you having me, Michael. I look at you when I read your story and did some background on you. You are an inspiration. I hope to consider you a mentor and a friend, and I'm honored to be here today as your guest.
Well, we definitely don't want this to be the only time we chat, so please, anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks again, and thank you to everyone. We will see you next time on Unstoppable Mindset. You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by.
I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibility, and is sponsored by Accessibility. Please visit www.accessibility.com. Accessibility is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.